Caterpillar. Mushan?
May it please the Court. I'm Clay Mushan, and I represent the appellant in this case. Your Honor, I want to address a couple specific issues with the Court. The standard here is a de novo review. There's a couple issues that I found particularly disturbing about the way this was resolved on summary judgment on the Latches defense. And the first issue is the issue of the destruction of key documents which Caterpillar says they had to have in order to defend themselves. They make the statement in their summary judgment argument that these documents were destroyed, and without these documents, they cannot proceed. What is important in this case on the document issue is not whether the documents were destroyed, but number one, when were they destroyed? Nowhere in the record does it identify when these documents were destroyed, and it's a pivotal issue in this case. The trial court found that if these documents had been destroyed after the IDHR case had been dismissed, but before the case was filed, Caterpillar had no obligation to retain those documents in that time frame. But the court also found that if they had been destroyed while the case was pending at the IDHR, then any prejudice suffered by the destruction of those documents was not the result of the plaintiff or the appellate, but as the result of the Caterpillar's actions. What the court never concludes is when the documents were destroyed. I repeatedly have made this argument. I've repeatedly made a request for Caterpillar to tell me if the documents are destroyed, when did it happen? They do not identify it. They do not identify it in their brief, and it is nowhere to be found in the record.
Anywhere that you can tell what their policy was generally on how long they were going to keep documents around?
They have not identified that to me as either, Your Honor. Number two, on the document issue, I asked for these documents in discovery. They were specifically asked for. Caterpillar came back and said, they're not relevant to our defense. They did not say they were destroyed. They did not say they were lost. They said they were not relevant to their defense. After the close of discovery, when they file a motion for summary judgment, that's when I find out for the first time they're alleging these documents are destroyed. Completely cutting off any opportunity I have to test whether those documents were truly destroyed, to take depositions of anybody from Caterpillar to identify when those documents were destroyed. And for this case to be thrown out on a latches defense because the documents which were destroyed without any evidence as to when those documents were destroyed, I believe greatly prejudiced the plaintiff appellant in this case, and any prejudice ought to be held against Caterpillar, not against the plaintiff.
Why did you drop the case just before the IDH, whatever it is, hearing?
There was one issue and one issue only, Your Honor, and that was the issue of punitive damages, which could not be recovered at the IDHR. For the entire period this case was pending before the IDHR, parties went into extensive discovery, which was why when this case came up and the issue had to be made, do we switch it over to federal court? The main issue was, where are we on discovery, and are there going to be any problems with discovery? And the answer was no. We had extensive discovery on both sides. And what is also pointed out in the record is all through this case and while it was pending before the district court, Caterpillar did not submit one request for request to produce. They did not submit one interrogatory. They only requested one deposition, and that was the plaintiff's deposition, and it was taken a week before the close of discovery. Now, as the district court found, Caterpillar's actions in this case were very disturbing to the district court for that very reason. Caterpillar made a calculated risk that we would not be able to find Ralph Alsop and have him available for trial. They as much as said so, and the district court did say so, that it was a calculated risk by Caterpillar. And that brings me to the issue of the unavailability of Ralph Alsop. Caterpillar goes on at length how Ralph Alsop is their key witness. He was the decision maker, and they cannot proceed to trial without Ralph Alsop. And he can't be found. Well, lo and behold, I do find him. Not only do I find him, I put a subpoena on him. He was located within 2 miles of the federal courthouse in Peoria. And then they come back and say, well, yeah, but he was just passing through. No, he's retired in a mobile home, and he's traveling across the country at his leisure. What the evidence shows is he maintains an Illinois driver's license. His vehicle is registered in Illinois. He has a bank account in Peoria. He is subject to subpoena in Peoria. He is within the jurisdiction of the district court in Peoria. I tracked him down. We put a subpoena on him. And their argument that he's not available for trial just doesn't carry weight. And then they come back and say, well, there's other witnesses that are not available. How do we know that? Well, they submit two affidavits, one from David Cook and Jeff Schaefer. I moved to strike these affidavits, and the court, district court never ruled on it. The problem was, once again, they were never identified as witnesses in this case until after the close of discovery. I never saw these two individuals' names until their affidavits showed up in a summary judgment motion. It was a blatant violation of the rules of discovery not to reveal these people and at least give me an opportunity to take their depositions. They're obviously available. Caterpillar got their affidavits. And yet I'm denied that opportunity as well. And then they submit, and they're in their brief to this court, they identify several witnesses. Robert Buchanan, John Hancock, John Winterbottom, Ted Todd, Lauren Cornish, and Terry Carter. The problem with that argument, they all come up out of an affidavit submitted to the court by Mr. Morris, an affidavit with which the district court acknowledged was insufficient. And now we come down to the last witness that they say was no longer available, and that's Mr. Vignazzi. I agree Mr. Vignazzi is not available. He's dead. He died 5 months after the plaintiff was terminated. How can that be held to be prejudicial resulting from something the plaintiff did? It was impossible to get this case to trial before that witness died. That is a problem that is faced every day, that people may die before they get to trial. And Caterpillar wants to ignore this case ever pending before the IDHR. What they want to argue is, well, gee, it's been 8 years. But it's not been 8 years that they've been sitting around doing nothing. This case was prepped and ready to go for trial. If there is a problem with faded memories, I would submit to the court that they have the obligation to prove that that faded memory occurred after the case was dismissed at the IDHR and before it was filed in federal court. Because they were faced with the same prejudice when this case was pending before the IDHR. If they were key witnesses and they couldn't remember, the question is, did they remember prior to the case being dismissed? And if so, why can't they remember now? And take a close look at the affidavit of Mr. Ralph Olson. He doesn't say he doesn't remember. He doesn't say he's not a resident of the state of Illinois. That affidavit was very carefully drafted by the attorneys for Caterpillar to show that, yeah, he remembers the plaintiff, but maybe not as well as he could have. There is no detail in what he can and cannot remember. And also, as the court has pointed out, the question is not only can a person have a memory lapse, sure you can, but time alone does not result in faded memories. And I think it's a key issue here. Mr. Alsep may have been able to be refreshed based upon other documents that were available. What was his testimony going to be at the IDHR? He's their key witness. He wasn't going to be able to testify for Caterpillar at the IDHR, and if he was, what was he going to testify to there? How did his memory fail after the IDHR complaint was dismissed? I don't think it did. And I see my time's limited, and I do want to reserve a little rebuttal. Thank you.
Sure. Mr. Warner?
May it please the court. 8 years delay, this sets the record for the longest delay of the half a dozen or so last cases in an employment setting that have been argued before this court. That, of course, is not only relevant on the unreasonable delay, but is also relevant on the prejudice issue, in which, because this court has said on a number of occasions, the longer the delay, the less prejudice that has to be shown. The delay is also inexplicable. For the first time, I heard an explanation for why they abandoned the case just before the evidentiary hearing, because of the punitive damage remedy under federal law. However, that remedy became available in 1991, at the time the charge was first filed and at the time that the plaintiff was terminated. So for the entire eight-year period, that was available to them in the federal court, and there's still no satisfactory explanation as why they didn't go to the federal court. Now, part of Mr. Mouchon's argument is that we were not prejudiced by the six-year delay to get to hearing before the administrative body in Illinois. We were prejudiced by that long delay as well. We were going to be severely handicapped in defending our case. Unfortunately, the Illinois Human Rights Act does not recognize a laches defense, and so we were not in a position in that proceeding to move to dismiss. The delay was caused over this entire period.
Did you have any responsibility for this delay? Interrogatories, responding to discovery, and all that?
No, it was all the choice of the plaintiff to stay in state court. 180 days after they filed their charge in 1991, they could have requested a right to sue notice and gone to federal court. They calculatedly chose not to do so and persisted in pursuing that claim through the department first on appeals and then into a formal complaint. When we first got the complaint in this case, we moved because there were at that time seven witnesses, undisputed were material witnesses, who had retired or left Caterpillar. Many had been gone for a number of years. Based upon how we read Seventh Circuit law at that point, we moved primarily because, as we understood the law, it was not necessary to show actual unavailability. It was enough to show the hardship of having to locate and secure the testimony of these seven individuals. That combined with some missing records, the continued accrual of back pay, which are also recognized as grounds for prejudice, we moved at that point. Judge Mim, although he ultimately acknowledged that perhaps he had held us initially to too high a standard, did not grant the motion at that point. We believe, and we would ask the court to again readdress whether all that needs to be shown in this context is that hardship in future cases, so that we can avoid the long protracted four decision proceeding we had in this case. But we then went on to show actual prejudice. First, with respect to Mr. Alsop, who was the key witness because he was the decision maker. And when we attempted to locate Mr. Alsop, he had left the Peoria area, had left no forwarding address. When we convinced the district court that he could not be located, and we clarified a misunderstanding with respect to the missing records, summary judgment was granted. It was after the summary judgment was granted that plaintiff's investigator, who had not been able to locate Mr. Alsop before that point, did find him in his camper in a campground in East Peoria. At that point, we were able to talk with Mr. Alsop. He informed us that he had been and would continue to be traveling around the country, living and camping with his children. He had no intention to return to Peoria after his brief stay. He was going to be unequivocally beyond the subpoena power of the court at the time this case went to trial. So we had evidence of actual unavailability as well as the hardship of locating witnesses. At that point, we also filed affidavits out of an abundance of caution by people who were responsible for the training of the plaintiff, and that was the issue in the case. The plaintiff admitted that she was told the reason she was terminated is because the people who trained her said she could not understand the training. Therefore, we filed affidavits by the person responsible for supervising the trainer, two of the trainees, who said they do not have specific enough recollection to be able to testify as to the relative performance of her and male comparators. We also filed the affidavit of Mr. Alsop, who testified that he did not have specific enough recollection of what he was told specifically about the relative performance of the male and female comparators. We also had missing documents. Now, it's not a question of when they were missing. Frankly, we don't know when we lost them. That was the risk the plaintiff took by delaying this case for 8 years. The relevance of these records only became evident, as we describe in more detail in our brief, when we deposed the plaintiff in the year 2000. Then we had to make another search because we had no knowledge that these records would be relevant until she changed the version of events at her deposition from what she had alleged in her charge. When we couldn't find those were another basis for prejudice. The continued accrual of back pay has been recognized as a continued basis for prejudice. Another factor that Judge Mim in his last decision recognized, which we would ask this court to also address, is a factor recognized by some district courts that at some point there is the inevitability of faded memories. That even if witnesses are available, when you have a case such as this that is factually intensive, witness intensive, going to turn on credibility, how people testify on the witness stand and how a jury evaluates their testimony, inevitably, with such unreasonable delay such as in this case, it has to be presumed that memories will have faded to the point where the defendant is prejudiced. And we should not have to go through a protracted proceeding to prove faded memories. It should be presumed as a matter of law. I believe all the other matters that Mr. Mouchon raised have been addressed in the brief, but if there are any questions with respect to those, I'd be happy to answer them.
I think not. Thank you, Mr. Warner. Mr. Mouchon?
Your Honor, on the issue of faded memories, I think it's a dangerous precedent for the court to rule as a matter of law that any specific time is sufficient for faded memories. I only have to point as far as the recent murder conviction down in Atlanta after 30 years after the fact. Apparently those memories were still strong enough to give sufficient testimony to convict a person beyond a reasonable doubt of murder. Time alone cannot be the standard. They must go beyond that and prove that the memory is actually gone and within a reasonable time as to when it left. On the issue of back pay, they are not prejudiced on this back pay issue. They were subjected to the same back pay issue before the IDHR as they are before the district court. There is no additional prejudice to them on the back pay issue. I would also note that Mr. Alsop was within the subpoena power of the court. He was served with a subpoena. Therefore, the court could have retained subpoena power over him to force his testimony at trial. And finally, I would note that Judge Mim did deny their motion for summary judgment twice, and he finally granted it, and in his grant, he specifically stated that the unavailability of Mr. Alsop is the one factor that tips the balance in favor of Caterpillar. It was 6 days later that Mr. Alsop was located, and a subpoena was put on him, and I would submit to the court that they have not proved their burden on latches, and this case should be remanded to trial. Thank you, the court.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. Court is then in recess.